Thanks for joining us for the Minor Tweak Major Impact podcast. We're excited to have Dr. Shai Silberberg as the guest for today's episode. Dr. Shai Silberberg is the Director of Research Quality at the NIH National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, leading the Institute efforts to increase the excellence of science and the completeness of research reporting. Prior to joining NINDS, Dr. Silberberg was an associate professor at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel, investigating the biophysical functions and physiological roles of ion channels. Shai, I would like to welcome you to the Minor Tweak Major Impact podcast.
Thank you, Anita. It's a pleasure to join you.
Shai, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you're currently working on?
Sure. So I'm kind of unique background, I think. I was born and raised in Israel, where I also was educated. I got my PhD in neurophysiology from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and then came to the United States. I did two postdocs and went back to Israel for a faculty position. And all this just seems pretty similar to what most academic investigators do. But then things changed because I came to the U.S. to the National Institutes of Health to do a one-year sabbatical, which led me actually to stay in the U.S. and to become a program director at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, and became interested in the quality of science. And therefore, after many years in the lab doing research, I now am the director for research quality, and I focus primarily on trying to improve the quality of science.
Great. And the reason why I reached out to you is in the book Rigor Mortis by Richard Harris. It includes a detailing of your insights into ALS clinical research trials and a subsequent note that the NIH requires rigorous experimental design to be shown in grant applications. Can you please tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So when I joined NINDS, I was exposed to a breadth of research that I was not familiar with, because I'm actually a basic researcher and ion channel biophysicist, which is a relatively rigorous field. And then I was exposed to all kinds of new experiments and publications in neuroscience, and not only neuroscience, that I realized were of not sufficient quality or rigor. This led me to try to convince NINDS to make changes in the hopes that that would also afterwards bleed across all NIH and outside of NIH. One of the key examples that caught my attention was this really sad story related to ALS. So ALS, as you probably know, is a neurodegenerative disease and typically leads to death within, 2 to 5 years. And in 2002, there were two publications that reported, actually three publications, that reported that the antibiotic minocycline can significantly extend the life of the mouse model that was used at the time to try to look for cures for ALS. And because ALS is so devastating, within 1 year from the publication of these papers, NINDS decided to fund a clinical trial, which involved 409 ALS patients who were treated each for 9 months. At the end of the trial, 4 years later, it was reported that minocycline has no beneficial effect in humans. Now, this is not surprising because there's no reason to think that necessarily what works in a mouse would also work in humans. The issue was that a year later, there was a publication from the ALS Therapy Development Institute, a nonprofit organization in the Boston area. And they, over 4 years, very rigorously tested more than 70 compounds in the mouse model for ALS. And they found that none of them had a statistically significant effect, many of which were previously reported to be efficacious, one of which was minocycline. And they did their experiments very rigorously. They could detect a difference in the life expectancy between female and male mice on the order of 2 to 3 days. This is really was an eye-opener for me. In the paper, they show very interesting results that suggest that the results in those publications were either due to unconscious biases or to chance because they used two small sample sizes. that is how I convinced that leadership that we've got to do something, because this was a real eye-opener.
Wow, that's a very interesting story. And it also leads me into my next question, because there are really a lot of different factors that could lead to bias in science. What do you see are some of these factors that can lead to bias, and how can somebody really minimize bias in scientific studies?
Oh, thanks for that question, Anita. That's a great question. So, you know, there's lots of talk now about the so-called reproducibility crisis and papers about the fact that scientists are dishonest. I don't think that those are the issues. The issues are how we do science, how we do experiments. And there are all kinds of unconscious biases. And so how do you decide, you know, how to address them? I was really taken back by several papers by David Rantzehoff. And in one of his reviews, he said that it's the investigator's responsibility to make sure that their studies are done properly. But he goes on to say that bias is unintentional and unconscious, and therefore that raises the question, if we are not aware of it, how could we possibly be responsible? And therefore, he suggests something which really caught my attention. He said, when we design experiments, we have to make sure that everything is equal between comparison groups throughout the whole process, from the design, conduct, analysis, and interpretation of the results. And that's how we can minimize unconscious biases. So examples for that. If you know which sample you're putting into which comparison group, or you know which animal you're going to assign to which group, or which patient you're going to put in each group, this can lead to unconscious bias where you do not put the different samples equally into the different groups. And to address that, two important factors are blinding yourself, so you don't know to which group each sample is going to go. And the other is to make sure that the samples are appropriately randomized to the different comparison groups. So you don't take all the healthy animals and unconsciously put the healthy animals in one group and the sicker animals in another group. And that can happen. You know, a good example of this is, let's say you're doing experiments with rats, and you put your hand in the cage and you take out four animals and you put them in one group. And then you reach in your hand into the cage and take another four animals and put them in a second group. You most likely introduced bias, because you probably, the first four you're going to catch are the more dorsal ones, the ones that, you know, don't resist being picked up and put in a different location. And the more aggressive ones will be the ones you're reaching out for last. So you introduced bias right there. So those are two very important factors that need to be paid attention to in order to minimize unconscious biases, and there are many others. Now, interestingly, we held a workshop in 2012 with the editors of leading journals, investigators, and reviewers in order to discuss what can we do to improve the transparency in reporting in journals. The idea being, you know, we don't know. There's lots of evidence that we just don't know if investigators blinded or randomized and so on. And this workshop led to a paper commonly known as the Landis et al. Paper. And in that paper, we recommended when, if you do animal studies, there are four things you need to pay attention to primarily. That doesn't mean that there aren't others, but these are the four that floated to the top. And that was blinding, randomization, sample size estimation, how you came up with the sample size, and how you analyzed the data. So those are the four things that floated to the top to minimize unconscious bias.
Great. That's very interesting findings. Shifting gears a little bit, how does that all translate really into clinical trials? Like, what do you see? Do we learn out of this if somebody is consider planning and implementing a clinical trial? Are there any things that we need to take over from those kind of studies into when we're actually doing trials with humans?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, what's interesting is the clinical trial field was actually probably a decade or two ahead of the preclinical world. So relatively in the early on, in like the 1980s, the clinical trial community started paying a great deal of attention to potential biases, and they came out with what's known as the CONSORT guidelines. It's extensive guidelines, not telling you what you need to do, but telling you what you need to report. And of course, if you have to report something, then that will get you thinking about how you should do things and so on. And among those, of course, are blinding and randomization and sample size estimation and so on. So these CONSORT guidelines, they were written for what's called randomized clinical trials. And so by definition, these experiments are done appropriately as far as randomization goes. In these studies, what the clinical trial community found was that if you don't blind, then you introduce biases. If you don't randomize, you introduce biases, and so on and so forth. So they came out with these CONSORT guidelines. It was only about a decade or two later that the preclinical world started paying attention to this. But as far as what designing a clinical trial has to take into consideration is whether the data that suggests that the clinical trial should go forward is sufficiently rigorous. And that's exactly the story that happened with the ALS story. Because with the ALS story that I told you earlier, if the NINDS at the time and the reviewers who reviewed the proposed clinical trial would have asked themselves, are the preclinical studies of sufficient rigor that justify starting a human clinical trial? My guess is that they would have not gone ahead with that clinical trial. But what happens often is because clinical trials are so complex, attention of the reviewers is on the design of the clinical trial. Do they have enough patients? Do they have sufficient sites to collect those patients? And so on and so forth. So they pay relatively little attention to the quality of the data that led to the clinical trial. And that has to obviously change. And I think that has been changing over the last decade or so.
Right. So you have been following this segment of the industry for several years now. How do you really see that everything is changing? Like, how has this industry changed over the past couple of years? Let's say maybe 10 years.
Yeah, so certainly not a couple of years. These are major changes, and it takes a lot of effort to see change. To tell you the truth, I had no idea that what we were doing at NINDS at the time would have the impact that it did. It really is amazing how things evolved. So as I told you, we started internally trying to see what we can do. And we made changes to how we review grants. But then the workshop that we held with the editors of prominent journals led within 8 months to Nature Publishing Group to make quite significant changes to how they review manuscripts. For example, they did away with the limits that they put on the length of the methods, which of course is completely against the logic of being transparent and understanding what's going on. So now you can write whatever you need in the methods so others can try to repeat the experiment. They also added quite a significant checklist that included the recommendations from the Landis et al. Paper and other things. And they also hired biostatisticians to help in the review of the statistics in these papers. So that increased the transparency in Nature Publishing Group. Other journals followed as well. So there's an increase in the transparency of how things are reported. It is common now to see papers, for example, in Nature saying this study was not done blinded or we did not randomize these experiments. And that's okay. As long as we know what they did, then we as readers or reviewers can decide whether we think this is sufficiently rigorous or not. So transparency is incredibly important. And our efforts also led to changes in the grant review at NIH. NIH introduced 4 new changes to grant review, or I would say enhancements to grant review, that are also designed to increase transparency and to help reviewers better evaluate the grant applications. The first was to look at the rigor of the key supporting data, which is what I talked about. And it's very important to see whether the proposed work is built on or is founded on solid data or not. We used to call that scientific premise, but people didn't really understand what it meant. So now it was changed a year ago to the rigor of the supporting data. The second pillar of these 4 pillars is the rigor of the proposed research. And the investigator is required to describe what measures he or she will take during the study to minimize unconscious biases. So again, they need to discuss whether they were blind experiments, randomized, how they came up with a sample size, and so on and so forth. The third is biological variables such as sex. It's very important to take into consideration biological variables that could impact the significance of the work. So for example, if you're, let's say, studying stroke and you do the experiments in juvenile rats that are normotensive, perhaps that's not the best way to do the experiments. Perhaps you should be studying aged rats that are hypertensive, because that would more closely mimic what happens in patients with stroke. So that's the third pillar. And the fourth pillar is authentication of resources. For example, we all know that there are lots of issues with the quality of and specificity of antibodies. Cell lines, there's data suggesting that up to 30% of cell lines are misidentified. So what the investigator plans to do to make sure that they're using good antibodies and appropriate cell lines has to be described in the application. So clearly, NIH and other funding agencies around the world have done quite a bit. As you can understand, there have been actually quite significant changes, but there's a lot that remains to be done. One of the big issues is changing the culture of science. As long as investigators are rated on how many papers they publish and in what journals they publish, as opposed to the quality of their work, and, you know, if they're asking clever questions, then we're going to have a hard time really changing how research is done. A grant cycle is on order, or in the U.S. at least, around 4 years. How could you possibly come up with great ideas to publish in high-profile journals within 4 years? It's just not realistic. So what happens is investigators rush studies to publication. Studies that perhaps could have benefited for a couple more controls, that could have benefited from perhaps a larger sample size, or experiments that are designed to disprove the hypothesis, not to prove it right. But they don't have the time. They have to rush studies to publication. So we have to change the culture, and here the institutions have to play a major role. So to this end, we are actually calling for the establishment of communities of champions, of rigor champions, for a grassroots effort to try to change the culture. And we published a recent paper calling for this, and also for developing an educational platform, because we need to improve the education on the principles of rigorous research.
That sounds great. And I think you did already do a lot of great efforts, and it looks like you've made great progress in that direction. And I'm looking forward to seeing even more happen in the scientific community towards a change to more rigor and reproducible science. And now I have a next question. And I know you're not in the lab right now anymore, but if you think back to your lab times, did you ever experience any minor tweak, major impact moments with any of the methods that you were working with in your research?
That's an interesting question. So kind of off the top of my head, two things come to mind, two experiences. One when I was a postdoc and one when I was a PI running a lab. So when I was a postdoc, we decided to use this technique called perforated patch recording. That's when you do patch clamping. And with this technique, you actually use an antifungal agent, amphotericin B, to punch little holes in the membrane of the cell right under the patch pipette that you're using. So you can gain access to the inside of the cell in order to record currents, but you don't really change the internal environment. So it's a little bit of a tricky technique. You know, I went by the literature and for, I would say, probably 3 months could not get it to work. At the end of the day, I'm going to cut a very long story short. It turns out that the substance that you use in order to punch these holes, this amphotericin B, you have to dissolve it in DMSO and you have to keep it in the dark. So I would put my amphotericin B into the DMSO in the tube that was covered with foil, so it won't be exposed to the light. And I didn't realize that it was actually not dissolving properly. And the reason it wasn't dissolving properly is DMSO is incredibly hygroscopic. It absorbs moisture from the air very quickly. And after 3 months, I figured this out because I couldn't read that anywhere. And as a result, I would buy a new bottle of DMSO. I would divide it immediately into little ampules. and store them on a desiccator. Then I would take one vial and only open it once. And that solved the problem. But that took 3 months of postdoc life. The second incident, which as a PI, is also kind of an interesting story. And I think this also is a good story related to diversity. I was studying ion currents in airway cilia cells. And we did these experiments on rabbits. We would take the trachea and remove a small part of the airway epithelium and try to dissociate the cells so that we could isolate individual cilia cells and use them to record, you know, patch clamp recording from them to see the currents in these cells. And what happened was we would take this piece of tissue. We would use enzymes to isolate the cells, and we had probably about 15 minutes to do a recording. And after that, we could no longer get the tight seal that we needed between the pipette and the cell. So what that meant is every time we did a single experiment, we'd have to go back and isolate another piece. It was a nightmare. And then I had a graduate student come from China, and he did something. Initially, it looked like magic. And he could have cells in the dish for hours and record from them, no problem. And what he did was, in retrospect, you know, made a lot of sense, but it wasn't why he did it. He used a tiny, tiny piece of tissue to dissociate cells, really small piece of tissue. And then the cells were happy. The reason they were happy is because in the epithelium, there are not only cilia cells, there are also cells that release mucus. So when we were trying to isolate from a big piece, mucus would leach out of those cells and make it impossible for us to form a tight seal on the cells with the patch pipette. But when he used a tiny piece of tissue, then we had relatively little mucus and we could record for hours. So the reason he did this wasn't because he thought of this idea. Coming from China, where he had very little resources, he thought that if he would use a tiny piece of tissue, he could use much less enzyme and he could save money. And that's how we solved this problem.
Those are very interesting stories, very great examples. Thank you so much for sharing these. And now our last question is our fun question. And also, if you do think back to your time in the lab, if you would have been allowed to make a wish for a tool that would have made your life, or in general, the life of researchers easier, what would that have been?
Oh, interesting. So I'll give a new definition to a tool. So I'm going back to when I was a student, okay? If I could have one tool that I would want, it would be a mentor. Or also proper education and the principles of rigorous research. Thinking back to when I was a graduate student or you know, even today, the system we have is a little bit distorted. We are still functioning like humanity functioned for 2,000 years, and that is the apprenticeship kind of mechanism. So you have the PI, and this PI trains his or her apprentices. And then if they, after a certain amount of time, they can go out and become PIs on their own. Now, not all PIs or mentors are necessarily very good. So what that would do, of course, is just create more, that would create additional generation of investigators that also won't be good mentors necessarily. So that's what I would have hoped for, that there would be good mentoring as a tool for my education. And one way to try to solve this is to have proper education in the principles of rigorous research, which is what we're hoping to be able to introduce over the next 5 years.
That's a good one, and also very, very important one. Shai, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your stories and insights on the Minor Tweak Major Impact podcast.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
This is your host, Anita, and we look forward to being with you for our next episode.
This program was produced by H Media. We'll see you soon.